From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, the governor and top GOP legislators agree. Let's do a budget deal now and save the road repair funding problem for later. We'll talk with the top Democrat in the state house about this new development. Plus, a new PBS Frontline investigation explores the unknown toll of the Flint water crisis, possibly unreported deaths from Legionnaires' disease.
What we're looking at is the number of pneumonia cases and the number of pneumonia deaths, which in some cases may be undiagnosed cases of Legionnaires' disease.
She lost her job with a local funeral home after coming out as a transgender woman. We speak with Amy Stevens, whose case goes before the U.S. Supreme Court early next month.
We're not asking for anything special. We just want the same basic human rights that everybody else has.
Those stories and more today for you on Stateside. Hello there, and welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. The future of transgender rights in this country could come down to a Supreme Court case from right here in Michigan. Later this hour, we talk with the woman at the center of the case. But first, Governor Whitmer and Republican legislative leaders agreed over the weekend to pursue a state budget for the coming fiscal year, separate from a long-term plan to increase road funding. The deadline for an agreed-upon budget is October 1st to avoid a partial government shutdown. Here's the governor today.
A shutdown would be catastrophic for a lot of people that are counting on us to get this done, and I'm not willing to play games with people's lives.
And here with us now is Representative Christine Gregg, Democrat from Farmington Hills, and the House Minority Leader. Representative, what's your reaction to this agreement to decouple road funding from the budget process?
Well, you know, we have to be responsible for the people of Michigan. I wholeheartedly agree with the governor that we have to be responsible, make sure that we don't have a shutdown, but we absolutely have to keep working on a road solution. That's what we are elected to do. And so we can do both. We can get the budget done, and we can continue to have these roads funding conversations.
Now, at the end of last month, you called Governor Whitmer's proposed 45-cent gas tax an extreme that likely wouldn't happen. What was the issue among House Democrats with that plan?
So what we were talking about is, like, we have two different approaches, one very direct, elegant approach about 45 cents and you're done with the problem. On the other hand, we had Republicans that were refusing to put out any ideas for revenue. So what we're saying is we've got to start talking and in the middle and looking at other ideas to raise the necessary revenue that we all know we need to improve our roads. And so House Democrats is, you know, back in June, we have been putting forth ideas that are a shared responsibility and a fair plan and approach to our budget and our funding, things like heavy trucks, making sure that they're paying their fair share in this solution as well, looking at business, where can they help out. We've got some tax loopholes that have been out there that are just basically tax giveaway for business. Where are there opportunities there to raise some additional revenue as well?
And we know the governor has said she's open to alternative road funding plans if people don't like her. So have there been conversations with the governor about those plans from House Democrats?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, we continue to put forth these ideas. You know, I also today called for a bipartisan task force, and the whole idea is, again, an avenue to bring even more ideas about revenue and make sure that we are approaching this from a fair share standpoint.
We certainly have been talking in Michigan about the road funding issue and road problems for a while now. What would a task force accomplish that hasn't already been talked about before?
So the main focus in the past has been what is the level of the issue. We know what it is. We know what has to be done, the revenue that needs to go forth to reverse the decline in our roads and actually improve them. That's a done deal. What we have to talk about are how do we get there? What are the revenue options that we have? Where do heavy trucks come into this? Where does business come into it? Where does a fuel tax come in? You know, there have been things thrown out about ballot initiatives, too.
Mm-hmm.
It's time for getting all these ideas and then actually get some recommendations and how, once we have the recommendation, the plan to get it done. So quit just providing menus and options and stuff like that, but this is how we're actually going to get it done.
Let's talk a little politics. So without the pressure of that October 1st deadline and get that budget done or risk a partial shutdown, is Governor Whitmer still in a strong position to get added revenue for roads from the Republican-led legislature?
You know, this is an issue where we've got to put politics aside, and we have to say what is going to move Michigan forward, what is going to improve our standing as a state and make sure that we have a great environment for people to raise their families and as well as business to come with great paying jobs. And if we don't put that first over politics, then it's going to be hard to move forward. So the Republicans to this point have not offered any real solutions to come up with revenue. So we have to continue to push them. Everyone needs to put their Team Michigan hat on at this point and make sure that we aren't letting up on the gas pedal and making sure that we're solving this problem once and for all.
So to speak, is she still in the political driver's seat?
Absolutely. She's the governor of our state, and she is working with all of us to find that solution.
House Minority Leader Christine Gregg on the job in Lansing as the search for road funding continues, now perhaps under a task force. Thank you so much for being with us on Stateside.
Thanks, Cynthia.
After a 9-year-old girl was killed by dogs as she biked in an alley near her home in southwest Detroit, there were many calls for city officials to do something to prevent another dog attack. Detroit City Council President Brenda Jones has some action in mind. She wants to see mandatory neutering or spaying for large dogs, and she is with us now. Council President Jones, what was your reaction to the death of Emma Hernandez, and when did you know you wanted to introduce proposed changes to the city ordinance?
Actually, my office had began looking at the ordinance that we had in place with the Xavier Strickland ordinance. We began looking at the ordinance after talking to the former Detroit Animal Care and Control Director, Charles Brown, and that was in the spring. So we determined then that the current regulations that we had was not strict enough to enforce for dangerous animals. And so we were going to introduce the amendments coming back this fall. Before we could do that, we had little Emma's tragic incident. And so once realizing we had that tragic incident occur, we realized that there had to be additional amendments to the law. And we are still working with the law department, but right now, the new proposed ordinance amendments would require a special dog license for dogs that are 18 inches in height and over 35 pounds in weight. And this would require the mandatory spay and neuter for the dogs. And this will help with assisting the city with managing and controlling the population of the large animals within the city of Detroit.
How would you see this enforced? I mean, would we see police officers checking large dogs as they encounter them?
What we're going to see is the animal care and control officers out there enforcing, not the police department enforcing, but the animal care and control officers enforcing the laws.
Okay. Well, and I want to play a clip for you a conversation we had just after little Emma was killed. We spoke with Teresa Sumter. She's director and founder of the Detroit Pit Crew Dog Rescue. And as she notes, her rescue is set up to take care of injured and lost dogs, not vicious animals. But she still gets frequent calls for help from Detroit police.
I have police officers contacting us to say, hey, we need help coming and getting these vicious dogs because Detroit Animal Care and Control is not responding. I have police officers calling and telling me that they have picked up dogs and brought the dogs over to DACC and nobody will answer the door. And they are supposed to be open 24 hours a day, 7 days a week to the police department. So what are we supposed to do with this?
Council President, what's your response to what she's saying? What are you hearing?
So what's going on right now, and what will continue to happen, is when you have an incident occur with a dangerous animal, you're calling 911. Once they get the call, they will contact the Animal Care and Control Center, and what we are possibly looking at right now with the administration is separating the animal care from animal control. Mm. Currently, right now, you have more people that are being trained, that are being added to the Animal Care and Control Center, and so we are looking at additional hours, also looking at having someone on call that once they get that call, they will have a car as well as the officer who can go to the site where they have received that call.
So you're beefing up staffing and hours at Detroit Animal Care and Control.
Most definitely, because we needed more.
Sure.
We did not have sufficient animal care and animal control officers out there.
Is there a current director at Detroit Animal Care and Control? Is there someone leading on animal control in the city?
Currently, the administration is seeking a Director for Animal Care and Control. They are doing a national search, and my understanding is that they are pretty close to having someone.
When you think of what the city puts in terms of time and resources on dog and pet control, what can council with your leadership do to better protect people from vicious dogs and or negligent dog owners? How do you want things to change?
So right now what we're doing is trying to educate. It's important that people are educated on the proper care for an animal. And so we are working with the Animal Care and Control, the Health Department, to get information into everyone's water bill to tell them exactly what the laws are, what they can and what they cannot do. That is so important. And we're doing a citywide marketing and outreach.
I know we've had little Xavier Strickland, we've had little Emma Hernandez. I'm sure you don't want another call that it's happened to another child or another adult.
We don't want to see anyone get their life taken from a dangerous animal. And so many people often think that we are concentrated on just pit bulls. I am concentrating on any dangerous animal. Any dangerous animal that's 18 inches in height and 35 pounds in weight.
Detroit City Council President Brenda Jones, thank you for your time and for talking with us on Stateside.
Thank you so very much.
Coming up, we talk with the director of a new investigation airing on PBS Frontline tomorrow night about the Flint water crisis and why it likely claimed more lives than was previously known. That comes up after the break. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. A new frontline investigation into the Flint water disaster airs tomorrow night on PBS stations. It's titled Flint's Deadly Water. The fateful decisions that resulted in the Flint water crisis are well known by now. On April 25th, 2014, Michigan Radio reported that Flint had officially switched its water source from Detroit to the Flint River, a cost-cutting move, they said. That untreated river water poured into people's homes, even as one Flint water treatment manager named Matt McFarlane realized the city wasn't ready. His sister, Tanya Petrella, spoke with Frontline.
I remember specifically the day before they actually flipped the switch. He called me and he said, Tanya, contact everyone that you know in Flint, anybody you care about, and tell them do not drink the water.
And it wasn't long before complaints began. Eventually, Flint and its water crisis were known around the world. Abby Ellis is the director of Flint's Deadly Water, and she is with us now. Welcome, Abby.
Thank you for having me.
You know, that initial stonewalling by state officials and then the lead contamination and poisoning of children in Flint has been very widely covered. But you look at another consequence of that untreated river water, and that's Legionnaire's disease. So remind us, Abby, how soon after the water switch was that people in Flint started coming down with Legionnaire's disease?
So it's actually very shortly after the switch. The first cases of pneumonia are detected in May. The switch was at the end of April. And the first confirmed cases of Legionnaires' disease were detected as early as the beginning of June. And so the outbreak really began right away, and it persisted for, 2014 and through 2015. And as you know, we didn't hear about it from the governor until January of 2016.
And at that point, the state told us that 12 people died of Legionnaires during the Flint water crisis. But I was struck by, in your Frontline piece, Flint City Councilmember Eric May told you Legionnaires is the one they tried to hide the most. In fact, you show us through emails that the state told the CDC, oh, thanks, don't call us, we'll call you, as the CDC offered help with the Legionnaires outbreak. What did you find behind all of that?
So one of the most important actions to be taken during an outbreak of Legionnaires' disease is an alert to the medical community. And the reason being, Legionnaires isn't that common. If you don't know that there's an outbreak of Legionnaires' disease, you may not test for it. You might not diagnose it. You might just treat the patient with basic antibiotic. And that antibiotic likely won't work if the patient has Legionnaires. And they can continue to get sick and in some cases die. So what we found is the most important action to be taken is to tell people, is to be upfront, is to identify the source of the outbreak and disinfect it. And what happened in Flint is this wasn't made public until 18 months after. And that's very unusual. You know, we talked to experts in other cities around the country who've dealt with outbreaks. And they say, after one case of Legionnaire's disease, that is enough to launch an investigation to, search for the source so that you can decontaminate it. When in Flint, in just the summer of 2014, you have case after case after case, total confirmed 90 cases. But what we're looking at is the number of pneumonia cases and the number of pneumonia deaths, which in some cases may be undiagnosed cases of Legionnaires' disease.
Yeah, it was stunning to watch your reporting as you looked at these pneumonia deaths in Flint in Genesee County, going through these death records, realizing that doctors were never alerted by the county. Tell us what happened the day that warning email was supposed to go out.
The person responsible for sending the email wasn't in that day. And the alert only went to about 15 people. And, we spoke to a number of physicians in the area who were not made aware, who actually didn't know about the outbreak, again, until 2016 when the governor holds this press conference. And so, we spoke to doctors at Hurley Hospital who were saying they were hearing rumors about an outbreak of Legionella, but they couldn't confirm it. And again, it's so important that doctors in the community know that there is an outbreak so that they can adequately treat their patients. And so what we found was that, while cases of Legionnaires' disease were popping up, there were also cases of pneumonia and there were deaths and at an unusually high rate for the summertime.
And the other thing you looked at were people who were diagnosed with Legionnaires during this outbreak, among those 90 diagnosed cases, who survived but later died.
Yes, and that's also a tragic part of all of this. Legionnaires is a very severe form of pneumonia, and it hits hardest the people who have compromised immune systems. But what we know about, impoverished communities is that there is just a higher rate of chronic illnesses. And so Flint was at an increased risk for the disease, for an outbreak. And those who survived the disease, there's a 30-day window that the state health department uses. It's sort of the standard methodology. If you die within 30 days of getting the disease, you count towards the death toll of the outbreak. And because Legionnaires is so severe and it takes such a toll on somebody's health, we decided to look at the number of victims who survived initially but died in the months and years prior, and we found 20 people, 20 additional people who've died.
And even in reference to the 12 cases the state will confirm, as we see in your piece, the state says, well, we can't definitively link those deaths with the water because they never tested the water for Legionella.
Correct. They say, we can't definitively say whether or not the outbreak is related to the water switch because, they say not all of the cases had residents who lived on Flint water and because they didn't test the water. So a lot of the actions that needed to take place during an outbreak to determine what the source was, those actions just weren't taken. And so, Yes, by 2016, they couldn't say for sure because they hadn't done the work to decipher whether or not, you know, the outbreak was correlated to the switch.
In your frontline piece, we meet a Wayne State University civil and environmental engineering professor. His name is Sean McElmurray. The state, as you show us, invited him in to investigate Legionnaires. Here's a clip from your frontline piece. This is Sean McElmurray describing a conversation with then Health and Human Services Director Nick Lyon.
The scientists say they met with Nick Lyon to urge him to step up surveillance for Legionnaires cases.
I remember my colleague telling him that if he didn't do that, you know, people could die. Unfortunately, Nick Lyon's response was that, well, they have to die of something.
Now, I know his attorney is saying Nick Lyon did not make that crass remark, and he blames any delays on the scientists. And the scientists also clash with former chief medical executive Dr. Eden Wells over whether to test and access to testing residential water for Legionella. Why did things go so badly between the scientists and the state, which had asked them to look into the outbreak?
That's a very good question. It's a question we had going into this. I've never in my career spoken and worked around so many scientists and medical professionals who had such a contentious relationship with the state. And, you know, it's very interesting that as they've contracted these guys out to investigate the source of the outbreak of Legionnaires, there's also a criminal defense being mounted. And this very health department that's overseeing this investigation to identify the source is also coming under fire by the special prosecutor and the attorney general. And so, you know, there are a lot of very interesting questions around that. I mean, might you not want to know what the source of the outbreak was, because then the state was very intricately involved in the decision to switch Flint to the river. They were intricately involved in the decision to turn on the plant before it was ready. And so when you have these grave consequences, including the outbreak of Legionnaires, I mean, you know, you could speculate as to why maybe they didn't want the source to be identified.
Now, we see in your frontline piece, you made a lot of efforts to reach out to the state and talk with the key players, didn't you?
So many efforts, yes. Yes, it's very difficult to report on something that's also undergoing a criminal investigation. And, you know, they had been investigating the state health department, the Department of Environmental Quality, and certain people in the governor's administration for several years by the time we got into this. And so we reached out to, you know, to everybody, to Nick Lyon, to Dr. Eden Wells, to the governor's aides, and nobody could talk to us. And they cited ongoing litigation, which made it very difficult. You know, we want to give that side of the argument, you know, time to explain to us what they were thinking at the time. But unfortunately, due to the criminal investigation, no one was able to talk to us.
Well, even folks who think that they know a lot about what happened in Flint will learn things by watching this new frontline investigation into the Flint water disaster, again, airing tomorrow night in PBS stations called Flint's Deadly Water. Director Abby Ellis, thank you for spending time with us on Stateside.
Thank you so much.
One of the most popular regular features here on Stateside is Cheers.
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 Stateside's Friday host Lester Graham and mixologist Tammy Coxon explore Michigan's cocktail culture, and the drinks that they presented through the years have been a big, big hit. Well, now Lester and Tammy have a new book packed with history, stories, recipes, and photos. It's called Cheers to Michigan, a celebration of cocktail culture and craft distillers, out from the University of Michigan Press. Tammy Coxon and Lester Graham, welcome and congratulations on your book.
Oh, thanks.
Thanks very much.
You know, I love a good cocktail. I love photography. I love the history of things. And I just thought you tied it up beautifully in Cheers to Michigan, just like you've been doing here on Stateside. So where'd the idea of the book come from?
Well, the book just kind of grew out of the episodes. Tammy had suggested there was a public radio station somewhere that had a show, and I listened to it, and it was horrible. So I thought, if we're going to do this, we have to do this quick, fast, and we have to make a drink. She was game, and we went from there.
Tammy, you write in the book that Lester actually encouraged you years ago to kind of walk down this path of creating these cocktails.
Right. It was a conversation with Lester that really gave me the confidence to reach out to, at the time, the Ravens Club and say, hey,
what would you think about me teaching cocktail classes at your location? And they were game, and that's really taken me to where I am today.
I know, Lester, you write that before you cross paths with Tammy, and I'm quoting you here, what I knew about cocktails would not have filled a shot glass.
Exactly. Yeah, I really did. You know, and I learned a lot because she started these classes. I went to a lot of these classes. And the other thing that really made those classes entertaining is she brought history of the drink, of the distilling process, all kinds of different information for different kinds of drinks, made it really entertaining. And it's become very, very popular. And now they're holding those classes at The Last Word and some other places, some other venues.
What makes cocktails interesting to me is the history and the ingredients and how much there is to learn. I'm actually a kind of person, I'll drink half of a cocktail, send it back, and try another one. Not because I didn't like the first one, but because I want to try more things.
And you want to not get hammered.
And I want to not get hammered, but I want to learn about it. And this has been a really good opportunity for me to dive even deeper than I already had.
Well, speaking of history, I learned so much reading Cheers to Michigan, particularly the fact that our state has a really long and fascinating history of drinking going right back to its earliest days.
Right. I mean, the French came and they brought wine and all kinds of other liquor with them. But we had a real dry spell because of Prohibition. We couldn't actually distill spirits in Michigan except for fruit-based spirits until just recently.
And to me, that's one of the most interesting things that we talk about in the book is how Michigan went from being a really backwards place that couldn't do those sorts of things to now being a model for legislation that other states across the country are adopting.
And looking at us, listen, what is a cocktail? I mean, what's the official definition? If I do my usual Irish whiskey and ginger ale, is that a cocktail or do I need to be a little more elaborate?
Well, it depends what decade you're in. If you were in the 1800s, a cocktail was spirit, sugar, bitters, and water. And that was the definition of a cocktail and what distinguished it from other kinds of drinks at the time, like a flip or a sling or a sour. Over time, of course, we start to mess with things and cocktail becomes a generic for any kind of mixed drink. So now when we want a cocktail, we order an old-fashioned cocktail or just an old-fashioned.
Okay.
Yeah, that's a cocktail in the old-fashioned.
To
clear up the confusion. So
Okay. That's
the original cocktail.
Yeah, my next cocktail class is all about old-fashioned.
What did you want this book to be?
Well, I wanted it to be pretty and interesting. And, you know, I did all the photographs or most of the photographs in there. She already had the interesting part down for us. So it was a matter of, can we make this actually into a book that people will want to pick up and a publisher would pick up? And we managed that so far.
Oh, I think you totally did. What was your goal for this book?
Like Lester said, part of it was taking what's on the radio and making it visual, because we take dozens of photographs sometimes when we're doing these spots, and it was really nice for people to be able to see them.
Well, I should note that so many of the photographs are courtesy of Mr. Graham and his camera, and those who may not know this, who are familiar with his work behind the microphone, may not know that he is quite the photographer. Your Instagram page is full of beautiful work, and so it's a chance to kind of show that off.
You know, what I really love about this book more than anything else is we got to share all of these Michigan spirits and mixers as well that a lot of people haven't heard of. But one of the things we ran into is we had a listener write us saying, I went out, I bought all that liquor, I made the drink, I hated it. And what was your advice to him?
Go to a bar that will make good cocktails, tell them the recipe, get them to make it for you, see if you like it, try before you buy.
Well, there were some other really good hot takes from your book, I will have to say. The ingredients, you talk about, for example, the juices you may use. What's your advice with ingredients?
Fresh juice is the most important thing someone can do to improve the quality of their cocktails. Doesn't matter if you bought a $12 bottle of lime juice from Whole Foods or you bought a 50-cent squeezy bottle. As soon as you juice citrus fruit, it starts turning bitter, and you can never turn back time on that bottle. So just squeezing fresh juice, massive improvement.
Another hot take, don't use those souvenir shot glasses.
Right. So a lot of the recipes that we talk about in the book have a quarter ounce of this and a half ounce of that, 3/4 of an ounce. And when you start having those different kinds of measurements, it's actually really important to be accurate. If you're just making a rum and Coke or a gin and tonic, just dump them in there. But real reliable measuring will definitely make your drinks better and more repeatable from time to time.
I love it when I'm at a bar and I see the bartender actually using a jigger. You know, if they're being fancy and pouring it out and guessing at it, I'm thinking, okay, how close is this going to be to the intended recipe?
And if you're well-trained, you can free pour really accurately. So don't necessarily discount it. But for home bartenders, absolutely use a measuring
device. All right, real quick, pick your favorite Michigan-born cocktail that you put in this book and give us the quick backstory.
Probably The Last Word, certainly our most famous these days. The Last Word is an equal parts drink. It has 3/4 of an ounce each of gin, green chartreuse, maraschino liqueur, and lime juice. This was invented about 1916. We used to think it came about during Prohibition, but we found a menu from just before Prohibition at the Detroit Athletic Club in Detroit. Last time it was in print was 1950, and then nobody had ever heard of it until 2004, when a bartender out in Seattle was looking around through old cocktail books, and he revived this drink, which has gone on to really revolutionize the cocktail world.
And that I know book is now in reprint. I just bought it.
That's
recently.
Great. Yeah. So that's it. What's your favorite one?
My favorite one. You know, I do love the last word, but I love some of the whiskey drinks. The rye whiskeys in Michigan are really, really good. There are several in there. But then I really like the one out of the Bayview Yacht Club by Jerome Adams, which is called the Hummer. If you like ice cream drinks, this is the Michigan ice cream drink.
I used to drink the Hummer a lot in the 80s. I had no idea. It was born at right here in Metro Detroit.
Right. And that's when I said when the last word is the most popular drink now, the Hummer is the one that around the world people had heard of before the recent cocktail craze.
Well, I can tell you, as one of these insecure people who thinks that patty and ginger is a cocktail, I feel like reading your book, I can up my cocktail game following your instructions, and I think anyone will be able to do that. And there is a book release party tomorrow night, so it's Tuesday, September 10th, starting 6 p.m. There you can drink the drinks, meet the authors, buy the book. It's at The Last Word, the craft cocktail bar on Huron, West Huron Street in Ann Arbor. And of course, you need to be 21 or older. Lester Graham, Tammy Coxon, their new book, Cheers to Michigan, a celebration of cocktail culture and craft distillers, out from the University of Michigan Press. Congratulations.
Cheers.
Cheers.
Coming up next month, the U.S. Supreme Court will hear oral arguments in a Michigan case that could have far-reaching implications for LGBT rights in this country. We'll hear one side's take after the break. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. A wolf has found itself a new home on Isle Royal, bringing the national park's total to 15. The 70-pound male was transported by the National Park Service last week as part of its catch-and-release program. The Park Service wants to increase wolves' numbers to manage Isle Royal's quickly growing moose population. Liz Valencia, Chief of Interpretation and Cultural Resources at the National Park, explains the crucial role these predators play in the park's ecosystem.
Without having that predator, functioning predator-prey ecosystem, it tends to get out of whack.
Well, last year, NPS brought 12 wolves to the island and wanted to bring more, but were halted by a heavy winter season. Valencia is hopeful that the Park Service will meet its goal of relocating 4 to 6 wolves this year.
We're happy with the success we've had so far. So they got one, right away the first day. And so that's a good sign.
Still, she is very aware of the difficulties that come with this effort.
There's a lot of moving pieces. So it's logistics is really the most challenging portion of it.
Ultimately, the National Park Service wants to bring the island's wolf population up to as many as 30. Amy Stevens had high hopes for the letter she wrote to her employer in July 2013. A letter that took her months to compose.
With the support of my loving wife, I have decided to become the person that my mind already is. I cannot begin to describe the shame and suffering that I have lived with. At the end of my vacation on August 26, 2013, I will return to work as my true self, Amy Australia Stevens, in appropriate business attire.
Those words propelled Amy Stevens into the heart of a legal case soon to be argued before the U.S. Supreme Court, a case that could be a landmark in the future of LGBT rights in this nation. Amy had worked for 6 years as a funeral director for R.G. and G.R. Harris Funeral Homes in Garden City in Metro Detroit. Through the years, she dressed and presented herself as a man. At home, she dressed as she knew herself to be, a woman. After she presented that letter to her boss, the funeral home fired Amy, and a legal battle began. And on October 8th, with the support of the ACLU and the Equal Opportunity Employment Commission, Amy's case will be heard by the U.S. Supreme Court. Amy Stevens is here with us now. Amy, welcome to Stateside.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
Well, it is good to have you, and we want to welcome Amy's attorney. Jay Kaplan has been staff attorney for the ACLU of Michigan's LGBT Project since its founding in 2001. Jay, welcome.
Thank you, Cynthia.
Amy, you worked for Harris for 6 years. What did you do there?
I was a funeral director and embalmer.
And how do you think you were regarded? What were your performance reviews and raises like?
performance reviews were always good. In fact, I got a $5,000 raise probably at the beginning of 2013. So I would say my performance was very well.
And through those years, you presented and you dressed as a cisgender man.
Correct.
How long had you known that that was not who you truly were?
Good question. I've known I was different since about the time I was 5 years old, but I didn't know exactly what was going on back then. Being raised in the South and being well before the internet, really didn't know what it was, had no way to find out what it was, and we didn't talk about things like that anyway.
That must have taken quite a toll on you.
There were some rough patches along the way, but not having known any different, I figured I was doing what I was supposed to do.
So what tipped it for you to realize who you truly were and how you wanted to live?
Well, it took some time. I did dress at home, but never left the house dressed.
And how did your wife Donna react when you told her your truth?
She was kind of worried about me in the beginning. And when it finally came out and I told her what was going on, she says, basically, is that all? And I said, yes. She said, I thought you might have been going out with another woman. And I laughingly looked at her and I said, well, actually, dear, I have been, but it was me. So she told her family what was going on, and it was acceptance from them. They had no problems. So that's when I started seeing a therapist, and with the hopes of finding out what was going on with me, was I normal or not? But it still wasn't as cut and dried as I had hoped it would be, because the therapist didn't come right out and say, well, you're transgender.
So that took some therapy and it took time.
Yes, she had me do some homework assignments at the end of our sessions, and she had me dress and go out in public. She had me go clothes shopping. And the point she said she was trying to prove was for me to make up my mind if I was comfortable doing what I was doing. And I found that, in fact, I was comfortable dressing as a female. And that's when I felt more at peace and at home with it.
And then you got to the point where you were ready to be Amy on the job. What were your hopes when you handed them that letter?
I was in hopes that everything would work out fine.
Yeah, and instead?
It didn't.
Jay Kaplan, Amy's fired. They offered a severance package, which she chose not to accept. How common is Amy's story, coming out as trans and then being fired?
Unfortunately, it's all too common. Transgender people disproportionately experience discrimination, particularly in the area of employment. Either they don't get hired for a job or they get fired from their job because of who they are, for trying to present and be their authentic selves on the job.
And now this has resulted in a case that is about to be heard before the U.S. Supreme Court, R.G. and G.R. Harris Funeral Homes v. EEOC and Amy Stevens. The funeral home, Jay, is challenging a Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals ruling that went in Amy's favor. Will you explain that ruling?
So the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals held that Amy was discriminated against in violation of Title VII, a federal civil rights law that prohibits sex discrimination. They explained their finding in two ways. One, that Amy, she was fired based on her transgender status, in the fact that she was assigned male at birth, and yet she was living her life as a female in accordance with her gender identity. So she was fired because of sex. Mm-hmm. They also made this finding based on comments that the employer made regarding Amy. It involved gender stereotypes. In other words, Mr. Ross, he didn't believe that there was such thing as someone who could be transgender, who could suffer from gender dysphoria, which is a term that says that you identify differently from the gender that was assigned to you at birth.
And Mr. Rost is Thomas Rost, Amy's boss.
Correct, okay. Correct. Mm-hmm. And he made comments that he didn't believe that Amy would be able to appear realistically as a female, and that he objected to referring her as a female, using female pronouns. And so that constituted gender stereotyping, and federal courts for more than a decade had recognized this form of gender stereotyping is sex discrimination, and it includes, you know, it's considered to be sex discrimination involving transgender employees.
And here we have the funeral home arguing that Title VII does not protect trans people and that the appeals court doesn't have the authority to rewrite that federal law, and the court exceeded its authority by expanding the definition of sex in a way that can change what it means to be a man and a woman. That's the argument?
Yes, that's the argument that they're raising, but it contradicts, you know, countless federal case law precedent. Every federal circuit court of appeals has uniformly held that this form of discrimination based on gender stereotypes is sex discrimination, and that it does cover transgender people. So in essence, the funeral home is trying to rewrite the law, and the Trump administration, which has submitted a brief through the Solicitor General in support of the funeral home, also is trying to rewrite that law. The United States Supreme Court more than 30 years ago held that this form, basing employment decisions on gender stereotypes, and this was a case involving someone who wasn't transgender, a woman who was denied a promotion in her job because she didn't act femininely enough. She needed to wear more makeup and to be more deferential to her male employees, that this form of gender stereotyping was actionable as sex discrimination in violation of Title VII.
Jay, amicus briefs filed on behalf of the opponents have argued that a ruling in your favor would reduce the number of athletic opportunities for women and girls. What do you make of that argument?
Well, it's disingenuous. Of course, that is not the issue that's before this court. The issue is Amy's situation. There's nothing dealing with athletic events or sports events. There are millions of transgender people who participate in activities in daily life, including sports activities, in accordance with their gender identity. But that's not what the court has to address here. The court has to look at this issue, whether or not what happened to Amy and the reasons that were given by her employer for firing her, whether or not that constitutes sex discrimination.
If you've just joined us, I'm speaking with ACLU Detroit attorney Jay Kaplan and with Amy Stevens. Amy was fired from her job as a funeral director for being transgender. Her case will be heard early next month before the U.S. Supreme Court. Amy, it's been a few years since this has been all playing out. What's it been like for you and your wife, Donna?
It's been an uphill struggle, both financially and health-wise. It's been a struggle, but we're hanging in there.
I know you've been coping with health problems. Your kidneys failed in 2014.
Yes.
Have you worked since you were fired?
I went to work for the Detroit Medical Center, Sinai Grace, as an autopsy deaner, and I was doing that until my kidneys failed. Mm. And since then, I have not worked.
Amy, you wrote an opinion piece for the Washington Post, and in it you wrote this. You said, "My case is about so much more than me or even transgender people." What did you mean by that?
The fact that an LGBTQ person can be fired from their job, they can be denied housing, any number of things, is not right. We're not asking for anything special. We just want the same basic human rights that everybody else has. And so far, we don't have those. We've been denied, and the way things appear, they would like to just erase us altogether, saying that we don't exist. But we do exist. We've always been here. And we always will be here, regardless of what they choose.
Your former employer says that having you come to work dressed as a woman, presenting as Amy, would force him to violate his Christian beliefs. And there are undoubtedly people listening to us talk who staunchly believe that he is correct and that being male or female is based on biology and not on how we feel. How do you answer that? What do they not understand?
For me to speculate on what they don't understand would be a huge mistake on my part. Everybody has their own mindset. Everybody has their own opinion. But for me, you can't decide anything without all the proper knowledge and research. You can't just jump on the wagon and agree or disagree with something when you know nothing about it. And the only way that people are going to learn about it is if we tell them and make them understand that we're people too.
Jay, the Supreme Court will be hearing arguments on October the 8th. So let's talk about possible outcomes. What would best case look like?
I think the best outcome would be that the Supreme Court would recognize that LGBT people are protected under Title VII under the theory of gender stereotyping, sex discrimination. I think, you know, even if you are a justice that takes a textualist approach and decides based just on the words, it's very clear, particularly in Amy's situation, that she was terminated from her job because of her sex, because of who she is as a transgender woman, and that her employer fired her because she was going to present her authentic self in accordance with her gender identity, and clearly that's sex discrimination. If the court were, in the worst scenario, to decide to reverse what the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals did and to say that, in essence, that LGBT people are not protected under federal civil rights laws that prohibit sex discrimination, then we go back to a situation where, unless you have specific civil rights protections for sexual orientation or gender identity, that it's perfectly legal to be discriminated against. And Michigan is one of 29 states that does not provide those specific civil rights protections under those categories.
If the Supreme Court decides in favor of the funeral home, would that not threaten all of the lower court rulings in favor of LGBT people?
It would, in essence, overturn those decisions, and it would say that unless you have the specific, unless you're protected under a specific category like sexual orientation or gender identity, then you can be discriminated against. It would upend so many things, including in the state of Michigan, where our Michigan Civil Rights Commission last year issued an interpretive statement saying that our state civil rights laws protect LGBT people under the category of sex. It could also upend Governor Whitmer's executive directive that she issued earlier this year, providing certain protections for LGBT people under this theory of sex discrimination. And it would result in the court overturning what the lower federal courts have done and how they've interpreted the law.
Does Amy's case have the potential to be as impactful as the 2015 DeBoer v. Snyder decision, the one that struck down the ban on same-sex marriage, a case also coming out of Metro Detroit?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And in some sense, even more impactful, because one might have the right to get married, but you return to your place of employment over the weekend on a Monday and you could be fired from your job. And so having civil rights protections in the area, of course, of employment and housing and education and public accommodations is essential to the well-being and the dignity of the LGBT community. So can't underestimate the importance of these cases and what this court is undertaking by reviewing these case decisions.
Amy, would you do this all over again?
Sure. No hesitation. You have to stand for something, or otherwise you stand for nothing. It may not be quite the quote that was once made, but it's close. You have to try to do what's right. And not only for me, but for all of us. And the only way we're ever going to get anywhere is by working together, not against each other.
And we've been speaking with Amy Stevens and Jay Kaplan. Amy's case, being fired for being transgender, will be before the U.S. Supreme Court. We want to thank you so much for speaking with us on Stateside.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And we do want to thank Amy for speaking with Stateside, despite dealing with a very persistent cough and cold. Tomorrow, we will hear from John Bursch, an attorney for a group called Alliance Defending Freedom. He will argue on behalf of the R.G. and G.R. Harris funeral homes before the Supreme Court. He argues Congress needs to pass specific laws regarding transgender status.
Every single other circuit at different times had said the exact opposite, that a claim that someone makes that they were treated differently because of their transgender status, that is their internal sense of gender and the way that they want to present their gender to the outside world, is not sex discrimination. And that's why Congress, on 12 different occasions, has considered bills that would have amended the definition of sex in Title VII to add transgender status or gender identity.
That's tomorrow on Stateside, but that's our show for today. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you for listening.